Common sense and the tracing of extra wires told Saxby that everything was linked to some central control, and certainly through telephone lines to some monitoring centre, for the outgoing lines were linked to the main alarm. Having been able to interrupt the unblinking electronic eyes in the garden, he could at least get to the rear door of the property without alerting anyone. From the hours of watching and taking pictures from the boat, he knew for certain that his target lived alone and slept in the large rear bedroom, overlooking the lawn that ran down to the lake. He reasoned that should he activate the alarm by smashing in the back door, Richardson would not wait timidly for the police to arrive, but would head down the stairs to tackle an intruder head-on. In those circumstances, Lenny decided, an armed interloper would have the edge. He would shoot and kill his nemesis as soon as he appeared. So he watched his own back, knowing he had prepared himself as well as possible, never getting too close, setting everything up so that he would make his move on an unlikely night in the cruelest winter month of February. To put things into perspective, though, Lenny was not to know what else was going on. He spent a weekend in Ascona in the days directly before Tess, followed by Bex, made the journey to Brissago. On the night that Tess arrested up in Berne, Saxby was in London to meet a man he knew only as Donoch and collect items from him in a pub on the corner of Broadwick Street, where it turns sharply into Lexington Street. On that night he paid a quick £200 for one small stick of plastique explosive and a 20-second fuse. The fuse pushed tightly into a slim, crimped metal detonator that would provide the initial force to touch off the eruption of the plastique and blow the deadbolt on the back door. There was a touch of irony here, for the pub was called the John Snow, after the great 19th-century Dr. Snow, who identified cholera as being spread through the contamination of water, in particular the water from a public tap near where the pub stands today. When Saxby flew out the next morning, while Tessa and Bex were travelling by train from Berne to Locarno, the fuse and detonator were snug in an umbrella handle, while the plastique was moulded into the interiors of a thick, flashy metal pen and pencil set that he handed over for examination with change and other metal items before going through the Friscombe scanners at Heathrow. Lenny arrived in Ascona a couple of hours before Tessa left Locarno, and he immediately started to prepare for the end game. He had no thoughts of what would happen after it had taken place. The only picture in his mind was of Ronnie Richardson dead, with a couple of 9mm bullets in him. It is quite possible that, under normal circumstances, he would have got away with it, exacting revenge by taking the life of the man he held responsible for his own disillusioned, sorry state of mind. Yet, through an unhappy quirk, he chose the worst night of the year to carry vengeance to its final conclusion. Richardson was alerted, not to Saxby, but to a possible threat posed by security and law enforcement agencies operating without the knowledge of the Swiss authorities. From the rear bedroom windows, Ronnie watched the dark shape pause for a good 10 minutes as he disconnected the electronic beams down by the boathouse. "He's heading up the path. I'm going down to deal with him." Tessa heard her lover's voice low in the earplug of the tiny two-way radio. She acknowledged the message, and Richardson slowly pushed himself back from the window and glided from the room. On the landing, he cocked the Browning pistol and gave an extra twist to ensure the noise reduction unit was fully screwed home. On the ground floor, he punched in the deactivating alarm code number on the keypad that was fitted inside a small cupboard between the stairs and the front door. He then moved silently to stand at the most convenient point in the passage to the rear door. The blackest, darkest place lay at the top of two steps, directly below the turning of the main staircase. From there, he had a clear view down the wide passage that ran the breadth of the villa. Between him and the back door were two archways to left and right, and a pine table on which stood a big china vase that had been turned into a lamp. The pink wash of the walls was grey in the darkness, and Ronnie could smell his own sweat. Outside, Lenny Saxby put down the big cocked Glock, held the tiny flashlight in his teeth, and extracted the plastique, which he rolled in his fingers, making it into an irregular ball that he pressed over the keyhole, pushing so that some of the explosive forced its way in. Just as they taught you up in Hereford when you first did the course, Len. From his belt he took the fuse and detonator, checking to make sure the fuse went tightly home, and that the bias cut end was clear. Carefully, he inserted the primer into the centre of the plastique, and reached for the Bic lighter he'd bought in London yesterday for this very purpose. In the darkness, Ronnie again made certain the safety was off on the Browning, slid his forefinger onto the trigger, and placed his right wrist over the left, bringing both hands up and aligned with the door some 5 to 6 paces away. Len lit the fuse, and in one movement scooped up the Glock and flattened himself against the wall. In the hallway, Ronnie did not expect to fire the Browning. He really did not foresee the events that were now seconds away. The plastique exploded with a flare of fire and a dull, jarring whoomph, low on the register, shaking the walls. Ronnie turned his head away and then back, as he realized the door was open, flicked outward like a piece of cardboard. He saw the movement of smoke being cleared out of the way by a body quickly passing into it. Lenny stepped through the door sideways, just as he were taught, offering the smallest possible target. "Stop, stand still, or I'll shoot," Ronnie said firmly, repeating it fast in Italian. "Jesus," Lenny breathed, bringing the big Glock up and toward the direction of the voice. "Christ," came the response, as Ronnie saw the movement, spotted the weapon through the darkness, smelled the explosive smell, and fired 2 shots in quick succession. The standard double-tap kill. They sounded like a couple of foot-foot noises, like someone expelling air through lips from puffed-out cheeks. Above, in the front bedroom, Tessa did not even hear the shots, only the stumbling crash as Lenny was hurled backward into the stream of darkness from which nobody has returned, the Glock arcing through the air to hit and crack the big china vase lamp on the pine tabletop, sending it crunching against the wall. What seemed like a deafening silence followed in the wake of the little explosion, the 2 shots, and the clatter of Saxby's death. Then Ronnie moved, compact steps, not wasting time, knowing exactly where to go and what to do. Both hands still up on the pistol, elbows tucked in. He went to the main switches in the hall, illuminating the passage. Liquid light poured onto the pink walls, and at the end the shattered door and the obscenity. 9 steps to the back door, and the body, kicking the Glock up the passage out of the way, the Browning still moving in the direction of the useless heap straddling the doorway. He heeled at the body, hard, then lugged it over with his foot, arm still extended, and fear swamping his nervous system. "Shit!" he gasped. "Lenny Saxby! What the hell?" And his mind went into an overdrive of questions. After the past, how could Lenny be working for the security service or the police? What the hell was going on? Did the local cops know about this? What kind of backup was out there in the darkness or on the lake? The telephone began to ring, and he slipped back through the passage to the hall. "Pronto," he breathed. At the distant end, the telephonist at the alarm monitoring service asked what the code was, and it took Ronnie a couple of seconds before he realized that blowing the door must have triggered the silent alarm down the phone line. He parroted back the number, adding that there'd been a stupid prank. The operator was not amused, and still asked, automatically, like a robot, if Signor Hungerford wanted the police to come out. Tess came down the stairs as he replaced the receiver. "We're going to have to get out of here." As he said it, he thought of how he might use the body to get out clean, dressing it in his clothes, then blowing the face off with a soft-nosed bullet. At least it would give them a few hours' start, if their nerves held, and if nobody else turned up. "Jesus," he thought. "It must have been Saxby out there last night, keeping close to the girl." Then, with a lurch in his stomach, he saw why Saxby might be working for them. They knew who he was. Somehow they'd cracked it, and knew that alchemist equaled Ronnie Richardson, one-time SAS, sometime Royal Marine, and that it takes one to know one. That had to be the reason for Saxby's presence here, the only explanation.